You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
In probably the most popular segment that I've ever done on All Marine Radio, it's Wednesday, so we'll do it again, Battlefield Studies, and it's the fifth installment, and I have to tell you that I absolutely enjoyed every single one, and today I've been looking forward to it all week. I started reading about Koh Tang Island and 2nd Battalion 9th Marines on the island in the Mayaguez incident, and so I started looking around, who could I have, and I reached out on LinkedIn to he wound up being a brigadier general, but J.J. McMiniman, and because he was an instructor when I was at the base school, and I don't know, after all these years, I still remember that, and but I didn't get a response, and so then I found this website. I think it's called the Koh Tang Island Beach Club, and I started looking for a Marine, and lo and behold, I crossed paths with my guest today, and that is Dan Hoffman. So, Dan, first of all, thank you very, very much for agreeing to do this, and welcome to All Marine Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm a privilege to be here.
All right. In order for us to did you know J.J. McMiniman?
Oh, very well. Yeah, we were, he was in the class behind me in the basic school, but we were in the same, infantry battalion, 2-9, for 13 months in 1975. And then I talked to him a couple times after that. And then, I snagged him to be a guest speaker at one of our reunions about 7-8 years ago now.
All right. Well, let's learn about you first. So born and raised where?
Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana. And
by Chicago, yep.
And how does the Marine Corps, how and when does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I had a lot of relatives, uncles and father and everybody else that served in World War II. None of them Marines. I went to college and graduated from Purdue and had a job that was related to the major I had. The girlfriend I had at the time did not want me to go into the service, so I did not. But I changed jobs and I changed girlfriends, and I checked out the Marine Corps and went to Officer Candidate School in January of 1974.
Okay, and so hold on now. I've got to stop you. So Dan told me that he was tell everybody what you're – so Purdue, that's an engineering school, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so what did you study?
Engineering school, nothing. I studied radio, television, broadcasting. I thought that would be a cool degree, and I actually worked in it for a couple of years. Did very well, but it paid nothing. And then they worked you 7 days a week doing, you know, hard stuff and getting hardly paid anything. And then there's five guys in line in the office the next morning trying to take your job, and I got fed up with it. I was interviewing U.S. senators and everything else for my news program, and then I was the TV director on the weekends. A lot of responsibility, but there was no future in it.
All right.
At that point for me.
So, and the year is 1974, and so you switch jobs, you switch girlfriends, and so you have no connection to the Marine Corps growing up. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar? How does it darken your doorstep?
I watched a lot of war movies, and I read a lot of books, and was a student of history. Loved World War II history, and I figured I'd go first class.
You know what? I'm similar. My dad served in the Army for 2 years, played baseball most of the time during the Korean War, and I had no connection to the Marine Corps. But I read, and you know, I watched movies and documentaries, and living in Southern California, I used to see them, and always impressed me. And when I decided that I was going to go in the military, I didn't visit with any other recruiter other than the Marine Corps. And so it's just funny. The lore and the history of the Marine Corps, how it gets into your skin. you go to the basic school, and how do you decide how do you decide on becoming an infantry officer? How does that happen?
Well, I was always gung-ho, and I knew that's what I wanted from the very beginning. I enjoyed it. I loved it.
All right.
The guys in my class teased me for loving it so much.
Talk to me, Dan. Talk to me about, you know, it's, but the Vietnam War has wound down, our involvement in it. Vietnam isn't over yet. It's still going on. But American involvement has almost ceased. Obviously, it still is in the news. So there's a huge, Watergate's going on. There's a huge, revolution, social revolution going on in the country. Yet you kind of run counter to all of that. Talk about, was the pull of your uncles and other family guys who had served in World War II, was that strong? Because I think most people don't understand when you grew up and the people that coached you, the people that taught you were all veterans, how powerful that was for young men in terms of doing their duty and wanting to serve.
They really didn't talk about it, but you understood it and you knew it. Basically, like you say, all your teachers and coaches and uncles and everybody had all served. My Uncle Hank was in the 1st Division, landed in the 2nd Wave on Omaha Beach, and fought all across Europe with the Battle of the Bulge and a couple others. Two silvers, two bronze, and three purples. And he didn't even talk about it. I really didn't know that he was even in the Army until I was, like, in high school. It was different for us when we got back from Vietnam. Nobody talked about the war then. Everybody, baby killers and crap. I was quiet for 20 years. You might wear a Marine hat or have a bumper sticker on your car, but you didn't talk about being in the service or doing that at that time. I was pulled into the Marine, wanted to be in the Marines because I wanted to be first class. I guess I liked the dress blues as well. I graduated TBS in October of 74, and I selected going to 3rd Mar Div in Okinawa, and I went to Camp Schwab in December of 74. Vietnam was winding down. It was almost over. They had the evacuation of Saigon, and we were on alert for that, but nothing was done. And we're sitting back doing our training. We were training in the jungles there of Okinawa to become qualified to be the detachment afloat for 6 months out of that 13-month tour. And all of a sudden, the flag went up that the merchant ship, the SS Niagara's American flag container ship, had been captured in open waters by a couple Navy gunboats from the Khmer Rouge. And they took the ship started to take it into the mainland of Cambodia. And they stopped at this little island 27 miles off the coast of the border between Cambodia and Vietnam called Koh Tang that nobody had ever heard of, ever. And
now you guys were out. You guys were out in the field, and at this point, you're an infantry officer. What company are you assigned to? What are you doing?
At that time, actually, I was a motor transport officer for 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines. But the battalion was going to be, they came back out of the field and were packing up everything. They took us and put us on airplanes from Padina Air Base and flew us to Utapau, Thailand, which was the only place they could launch the attack from. I'll get into all that because a bunch of goofy things going on.
Right.
But I went to the battalion commander and asked if I could go, and he put me in as the weapons platoon commander for Golf 29, which ended up being the initial company in on the first assault, which was pretty fortuitous.
Right.
But
Saigon
had fallen.
Right.
There was all the refugees and on the ships in the boat That was 2 weeks earlier, and everybody thought the Vietnam War was all over, and all of the assets had basically been pulled out in the southeast. When they needed troops to go in, we were part of the 3rd MARDIV on Okinawa. We were actually the only troops available. And to get us there, to launch the assault on this little island off the coast of Cambodia, the only assets available were Air Force HH-53 helicopters.
Nothing else available.
Let
me slow you down before we go there. Talk to me about the composition of your company. Tell me about the company commander. Are these guys all Vietnam guys? Are they all multiple tour Vietnam guys? Do you have a fair amount of combat experience in the company as you guys?
The only ones that had combat experience were the company commander and the senior staff NCOs, company gunny, and a couple of the staff sergeants. E5s and below, nobody had any combat experience. XO and all the junior lieutenants, of course, none at all.
Okay.
Most of our Marines were also very young. We had a lot of 17, 18, 19-year-olds. This was, like I say, after Vietnam. And all of the experienced troops and pilots and everything else had all been pulled out. So it was just us training in Okinawa.
You know, it's amazing the demographics of the Marine Corps, you know, have consistently been, you know, 60% of the Marine Corps is under the age of 26, and about 66% of the Marine Corps turns over every 3 years, which is amazing mm-hmm. when you think about it. And so, you know, if most guys were out of Vietnam, what, 70, 71 or 71, 72, then you can see, you know, in 3 years, you know, when you turn over like that, a lot of your combat experience has either EAS out of the Marine Corps or PCS to other jobs. And so in 1975, wow, that's amazing. Your company commander's name is?
Captain James H. Davis. He got a Silver Star in Operation Dewey Canyon under Wesley Fox.
Wow.
So he got some combat experience.
Okay. All right. So talk to us about you moved to Kadena. And you guys, did you, at what point did you become familiar with where you were going and what you were going to do? So I would imagine Kadena, all you were told was, hey, get on trucks, we're going to Kadena, there's something going on. And did you get told at Schwab?
We just knew that a merchant ship had been captured. We had no idea where we were going, at least at my level. The guys had all been in the field, and they were in the field for a training exercise for 3 or 4 days, so they were sleeping in the mud and filthy and dirty and having been eating sea rats and not sleeping well for a couple of days, so they were in bad shape already. They brought us back in, everybody packed up their sea bags and put their trash together, and then they put us in the trucks, drove us to Kadena, and then we flew straight to Utapau.
Okay, and so just so we have some sense of time, what day is that?
Okay, from the moment the flag was raised, or however you want to call it, that says 2-9, you're going into combat, so the last helicopter leaving the island at the end of this combat operation was less than 48 hours. It was ridiculous. We moved went extremely fast, and the last 41 names on the wall, the last casualties from war in Southeast Asia are all from this Koh Tang Niguel's operation. And part of that was to the floor planning.
Okay, so.
They were, President Ford and Kissinger were afraid that this merchant ship and its 40-member crew, most of whom were Americans, would be taken into the Phnom Penh harbor there, and then we'd have another Pueblo incident where they couldn't get the crew back, and it would be a huge embarrassment and this and that. So they did everything they could as quick as they could to try to prevent that from happening.
Got it. And so my recollection is on May 12th, the Mayaguez is seized, it's important that people understand, you know, the timeline in all of this, and so that happens on the 12th, and you guys are within the period that we're talking
the
about?
The 13th, we're flying into the operation, yes.
So that's kind. And then the 14th, the operation gets executed, yes?
No, 15th. The first helicopters were in at 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning on May 15th, 1975. And the last helicopter pulled out a little bit after 7 that night.
Tell us about you know the movement and the flight into Thailand. Were guys nervous? Were they excited? What was the mood of the company?
I was a little bit excited. We didn't know what we were getting into, of course.
Right.
The intelligence was horrible. We didn't have any of that in the beginning. There were no maps or anything. Once we got to Utapau, we were actually just camped out there on the tarmac, right next to a big Blackbird spy plane, which we weren't supposed to see. Guys were going over and standing by and taking pictures for about 20 minutes until somebody said, "Hey, you can't go over there." The other thing was that they started passing out ammunition, and they're giving out bandoliers and hand grenades left and right, handing them out like candy. And, of course, everybody had one hand grenade in training with two safety officers breathing down your neck. And all of a sudden, they're just passing out hand grenades left and right. Load up, take as many as you can. You may need it. And that was one of the advantages we had, that we were loaded for bear. But we're just laying there on the tarmac trying to sleep, and they had their gear on because, of course, we're supposed to go. And I had my flak jacket on and my canteens in the back, and I'm sitting there, and I guess I fell asleep, and I laid down, and I'm waking up. I'm really uncomfortable, and I jumped up. The hand grenade is in my flak jacket pocket. I'm laying on top of it. So a lot of guys didn't get much sleep, but after that, I didn't get any sleep at all.
Talk about the planning and the order that you guys received. Were you guys a part of?
Yeah.
Because to paint a picture historically, you have the Air Force in charge of the operation, and at literally at the MEF level and at the joint level, they have a good idea or a pretty decent idea intel wise what they believe is on Koh Tang Island, and so at the Corps and the MEF level, what you have is you have estimates from between 100 to 500 Cambodian soldiers on this island with heavy weapons. That never makes it
we
down.
We never knew that.
Yeah, that never makes it down. In fact, when they do the confirmation brief, they didn't call it then at the time, but when they do the final confirmation brief, the guys that are going to control the battle, that are going to go up in an electronic version of the C-130 to do command and control, they don't even attend the brief. They're off getting ready to fly. So you have this disjointed and you guys are never co-located in your preparation. So things that Marines today take very much for granted, those lessons are born out of this experience on Koh Tang Island, the preparation that went into that.
This operation was studied and it was used in War College and Quantico, every place. All the things that went wrong. There wasn't a rapid deployment force. I mentioned earlier that we had to be hauled by Air Force helicopters. They never had Marines on their helicopters in their lives. They certainly didn't know how to land on a beach under heavy fire. Didn't know how to land on an aircraft carrier. They had to do later. They were search and rescue. But that was the only helicopters that were there. The intelligence we had at Utapau, there was no maps of the island at all. There was some little hand-drawn thing that was blown up, and it was just a contour. The island's about 5 miles long. It was heavy, dense jungle with no place to really land a helicopter. The crew was supposedly in the center of the island where there was a couple little couches. They weren't even buildings, but the only place you could land a helicopter was on the northern end of the island. There were two strips of beach, one on the west side and one on the east side. And this was just a small, sandy, rocky beach, and that were basically the only place you could land a helicopter, and those were where we were going to go in. The intelligence we had was so poor, they said the island would be protected by 15 to 20 fishermen/pirates that might have automatic weapons. Well, of course, everybody's got the AK-47. That's automatic in the first place.
Right.
But we went in up against better than 400 seasoned Khmer Rouge Marine troops with heavy machine guns, mortars, 90mm anti-tank guns, a lot of heavy machine guns that were dug in pits. The island was in dispute between Vietnam and Cambodia. There had been a rumor that there was oil in the area, so that's why the Khmer Rouge had reinforced the island, and we were sent into a mess. It was just horrible going in there.
I talked to me about Captain Davis's order, and as we finish off kind of the general situation, talk to us about the order that Captain Davis gave and the scheme of maneuver that you guys, based on the intel assessment that you had, as screwed up as it was, tell us how you guys, and again, just so everybody knows, if you haven't seen it, there's maps on the website. I stole them from Dan's speech that he gave to the American Legion. So Dan, the maps that you use and you put up during your speech are going to be on our website. So don't be afraid to refer to them. And you obviously know them. So you can kind of walk us through the scheme of maneuver, that Captain Davis laid out for you as you guys would go into the island.
Well, we were limited by how many helicopters there had and how many they could move to the operation. Utapau to Koh Tang was about a two-hour flight by these AH-53s. So the initial wave, there were three helicopters that actually landed Marines on the Midwest. They captured that. They were from 1-4, and they eventually got the ship steaming and moving away. But for landing on the island, it was a grandiose plan on the West Beach. We were supposed to land two helicopters with about 25 Marines in each. Captain Davis was supposed to work up a blocking force on the West Beach, and the remaining seven helicopters with mostly the rest of that company and the battalion staff and headquarters were supposed to land on the East Beach, form up, push through, and then meet up with Captain Davis, and then sweeps through the whole island like a grandiose World War II battle plan. The jungle was so thick you couldn't even move through it. But the biggest problem we ran into was the heavy fire that messed us up at the very beginning.
Okay, so the scheme maneuver is the now the map says that 3rd Platoon, which is the blocking force, I think, goes in on East Beach.
Nope, they went in on West Beach. Our 3rd Platoon is Lieutenant Cicery's platoon. Let me just tell you how it happened. We were supposed to go in at dawn with a surprise attack, but there was a problem with the War Powers Act and the President and the anti-Vietnam end of war stuff, and he had to notify ex-members before he could actually use force. So we're circling and circling and waiting and waiting, and they had to get the actual permission before we actually went into the island. For what it's worth, also, there's huge, horrible command and control problems. Part of that was, for the first time, the White House or the Pentagon or whatever command and control was taking part of it there, was involved in the decision-making and issuing orders, as was Herb Mardiv, SyncPAC, and the bird colonel, Air Force colonel, who was in charge of the operation, who's back on Utapau.
Okay,
so
everybody draw that wire diagram. You have SyncPAC, you have the White House, right? You have the White House, you have 3rd Marine Division, and then you have at the core level, you have those guys, and then you have the airborne command and control that is supposed to be doing the combat operations center command and control. And remember, these guys didn't go to the confirmation briefs. So they're airborne, and you have all these other people, by the wonders of telecommunications at the time, can now probably for the first time in history, can be patched through to a tactical command and control center and you have them mucking it up as well. So just everybody keep that picture in your head.
It was horrible. It was horrible, and it was ridiculous. I tell the story about Rifle Company XO, and he's sitting on the beach under fire. He's got one radio in one hand talking to somebody. He's got another radio hand sitting in the other hand telling him, hold on just a minute, I got to do this, I got to do this. And he's trying to call in airstrikes. He's trying to control the movement of two platoons under heavy fire. And this other radio operator throws his other hand in his face. This colonel has to talk to you now. That was our command and control. The Cricket was the call sign for the Airborne Command and Control Center. And the beginning of the operation, they didn't even know what day it was. We were supposed to have air control for fire support, and some brigadier general in the Air Force had decided, we don't need to send the OB-10 Broncos in. We can do our own command and control. And for the first half of the day, it was horrible. We had fighters come in and off of the Coral Sea and from other air bases. And it's a tiny little island, and our forces are all spread out all over the place, and I'll get into that in a minute. But here I am, a boot lieutenant, a couple months out of basic school, and I'm calling in airstrikes all of a sudden. I had the hour class that I sort of paid attention in, and never in a million years did I think I'd be calling in airstrikes, but man, nothing was going right. The Airborne Command and Control finally got their act together in the afternoon, and they did bring in the OB-10 Broncos, the call sign NAIL for our operation, and they saved the day.
All right, so explain to everybody who doesn't know what an OB-10, who has never seen an OB-10 Bronco, what was an OB-10 Bronco? What did it do?
It's a small airplane, single pilot, used for command and control, directing air fire. It could be artillery fire, could be mortars, could be other aircraft. In this case, it was also naval gunfire off one of the ships. They know their ship, and they are supposed to be in charge of everything. The Cricket, the Airborne Command and Control Center, was so screwed up. When one of the naval ships came on station, the USS Henry B. Wilson, who had been skating for days to get to the island in time, and they were a lifesaver, Wilson comes on board with their call sign and to say, we're here, Rob, what do you want us to do? This big naval destroyer guided missile, and the command and control center, circle the 10,000 feet so we can figure out what we want to do with you. For the Navy ship. And they said, well, we can't do that.
When you read it, I read that, and the USS Wilson checking in. Can you imagine what in the Wilson's CIC, what they thought? And I have to tell everybody, the Navy that you're going to hear about and the Air Force that you're going to hear about, I would tell you, are a lot different. I mean, the courage of these Air Force pilots will take your breath.
I'll get into that.
Will take your breath away.
We're alive today. Yes.
The courage of these commanding officer of these destroyers, especially the USS Holt, these guys are ballers. They come in, a thousand meters from shore, and they let it rip. They launch their dinghy with a 50 cal. So in the story that you're going to hear Dan tell, I mean, it makes your heart swell. The courage and the selflessness that you see across the board in this incident. In fact, I'll tease the end of this. The story of this story is that this should have been an American military disaster. But the courage and selflessness of these Marines, of these airmen, and these sailors yanks a humiliating defeat out of the jaws of death. And it's the only reason that it happened. And I would encourage you, if you've never read about the Mayaguez and Koh Tang Island, read about it. And a little bit later, I'll ask Dan, to point us in the right direction in terms of quality reading stuff. But it is a great read, all right. And you will be blown away by their courage and selflessness across the board. Unbelievable. And then, like I said, a Navy warship checks on station, gets told to orbit at 10,000 feet. Unbelievable. But there's a picture of an OV-10 Bronco in the slide deck, so you can just flip through the slide deck and you'll see what an OV-10 Bronco is. But you know, they had a lot of marking devices, which we didn't have lasers back then, so you had to kinetically mark with white phosphorus. So they had rockets and things they'd mark with. They had long station time, big glass canopy, you'll see in the picture, and it was a great piece of gear. The Marine Corps flew it for a long time before it ultimately retired it, before they retired it. So you guys are headed into the beach, Dan, and how did things go in terms of the opening waves of the helicopter?
Well, they heard us coming, they see us coming, and they were loaded for bear, and they started just blasting away. The first two helicopters that landed on the East Beach, 931 went down in a ball of flames and about 6 feet of water. 13 were killed immediately or pretty quickly, and then 13 swam out to sea. The fire was so intense, the machine gun fire was so intense they could not get out up onto the beach. And they were later picked up by the crew of the Holt. The second helicopter in Knife 23, Knife being the call sign for the CH-53s, and that helicopter, we believe the tail end of the helicopter was blown off with an RPG, literally blew the tail end off. The pilot miraculously lands it on the beach, and the 20 Marines and the 5 Air Force crew, several of who are wounded, make it into the shoreline, into the rocks, and set up there a small defensive perimeter by themselves. To explain the situation of how seasoned the troops were that were against us, they could easily have overrun those 25 guys, but they let them sit there all day, kept them pinned down, and used them for bait so that other helicopters were coming in to try to pull them out of there, were damaged or shot down, and it severely reduced the helicopter assets we had, which made a big deal in the later in the day, especially for extraction. On the opposite side of the island, which is only about 1,000 yards away, the first helicopter in lands with the second lieutenant and 20 Marines, most of them green, and they're under heavy fire, and they're just sitting there in the defensive perimeter. The helicopter gets off under heavy fire, goes out all over the water and crash lands. And all these young 18-year-olds watch the helicopter crash in the water. The second helicopter that's supposed to go in with them contains the company commander, and it is shot up so bad. They tried to land a couple different times, but it was shot up so bad they had to they couldn't land, couldn't offload the troops, and it went back to Thailand where it actually crash-landed. But the crew and the Marines on it were hurt, and they were picked up later. And then the company commander actually came back into the operation very late that afternoon. So the first four helicopters of the first wave, these big HH-53s, are all shot down. And that was the start of the operation. I was on Jolly, Jolly Green Giant, call sign 42, and was supposed to land like the third helicopter on the East Beach with the rest of the battalion, at least the command staff and most of Golf Company. The two Air Force captains saying, there is just too much fire on this East Beach. We cannot land here. We cannot do anything wrong. What are we going to do? They decided without any other orders or any other information or anything else, and they offloaded troops onto the West Beach. One helicopter in ahead of me, offloaded about 10 Marines out of it, and it got shot up and they took off. And then the helicopter I was on landed, and we offloaded our, 20, 24 Marines on it. And then for what it's worth, it was so badly damaged, it flew back to Thailand, but it couldn't fly anymore that day either. So we're sitting there, in the defensive perimeter. We linked up with the other guys were there, and we had about, less than 60 Marines, several of whom are wounded, and we're in this defensive perimeter and just taking heavy fire all over the place. So we just had everybody dig in and return fire the best we could. We're trying to get our radios, trying to get our support, not have any luck with anything. We were supposed to land in the middle of a big battalion operation with 7 helicopters and a company and a half of Marines, and instead you got 2 second lieutenants sitting there trying to figure out what day it is and taking a lot of fire.
Okay, let me ask you, so, and your FAC in all this, I assume that your FAC was in the first wave. Where's your FAC?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'm getting there.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. The next thing that screwed up the operation was the helicopter that the battalion commander was in. On his helicopter, thinking he was going to land in the middle with everybody else, is the battalion commander, his radio operators, the battalion S3, the FACs, 2 tubes of 81s, and the battalion doctor, and all of his corpsmen. And they took so much fire they couldn't land, but the pilot somehow landed them on the beach about 1,500 yards south of the perimeter that I was in, on the west side of the island. So you got the command element isolated. There's only 3 riflemen and the whole 29 Marines that were with them together. A lot of 45s and 2 tubes 81s and the doctor and et cetera, et cetera. But it's very hard to fire and maneuver with only 3 riflemen. So there at by 8 o'clock in the morning, we've got 25 Marines and 20 Marines and 5 Air Force crew isolated on the east beach being held down for bait so that the other helicopters try to come in and rescue them. We've got about 80 Marines now, probably about 65 effective, on the west beach, and 1,500 yards south of us is the battalion command element with 29 Marines, but well, not all Marines, maybe Dr. Corman, et cetera, but they're not actually a fighting unit. So we're spread all over the place with heavy dug-in positions in between and all around us, and no fire support, no air support.
You know, Dan, and you alluded to it, but let me kind of pull a little bit more out of you. When you said the command element, which is 1,500 meters essentially south of you guys on West Beach, they had 3 riflemen.
Yeah.
At that time, everybody else carried what weapon?
45 so and 1911
A1. So you had, and we don't do that anymore. You carry rifles, but you can imagine at the time, everybody's ashore, you have 3 rifles, and you have about 28 pistols. And it must have been.
Well, there wasn't even that many because it was the doctor and, yeah. S3 and the fact and everything else. The other fact was in the helicopter that got shot down on East Beach, and he actually got a Silver Star. He's swimming in the water with an Air Force survival radio trying to call in airstrikes. But there was no, the command and control problems were significant.
Okay, so,
we didn't get any reinforcement. There was a 5th helicopter that was supposed to come in, and he was supposed to land, the pilot could not land. The fire was too heavy. He couldn't land. He landed, and 4 or 5 guys would get off, and then he'd have to take off again. And he made 5 attempts at landing. He had to actually go above and get refueled in midair. And then finally got in about 9:30. We were actually able to put a few wounded on him before he took off. So by 9:30, we have a mess of an operation.
All right.
It's 3 units separated.
Okay, so your weapons platoon, golf company at this time. Who are you guys talking to, Dan? Are you talking to the airborne COC? How are you fighting through the fact that you don't have a UHF radio to talk to aviation?
Well, that was part of the problem, and I think that's what Dick Keith, our XO, was working on. I mentioned before that he had 3 radios in his face and was not able to be as effective as he should have been. I had a radio, but basically we were just talking to the other platoon commanders and trying to figure out what was going on. I was made aware of the battalion command element being separated, and I started grabbing guys. We were going to go out of the perimeter, and we actually moved south to try to get to them. I grabbed positive assault squad, they called it later. I actually got the first sergeant and a radio operator, one machine gun team, and several riflemen. All boot kids. Nobody had ever been in combat before. And I said, you and me, you're going with me. Come on, let's go. And we tried to go through the jungle, but it was just too damn thick. You couldn't even move. So I had them crawl back. All this was under fire, and we were throwing a lot of grenades. Luckily, where we landed was a hooch that must have been a storage area for the Khmer Rouge, and there were bags and bags, clear plastic, not like a garbage bag, much thicker than that, that had 50, 60 hand grenades in the bag, and we were just passing off these grenades all over the place. But the tremendous advantage we had was that we had flak jackets and helmets, and the Khmer Rouge had nothing but a cloth hat and you know, cloth shirt. So the grenade battles were very effective. So when I started going to help link up with the isolated command element.
Okay, so let me pause you there. So paint a visual picture for us as we look at the map. We see kind of you guys are in a 180 by at 9:30 with approximately how many Marines total, Dan?
I think we had like 80 at that point.
About 80. Okay.
The total was 127 Marines.
Okay.
And that's after we got reinforcements late in the afternoon with a 2.5 helicopters from Echo Company.
Okay. So it's a reinforced platoon, almost two platoons. Now, what part of your weapons platoon is ashore at this point?
We had the machine guns attached out. We had the 3.5-inch rocket launchers, and we didn't bring them. And we had 60 mortars, but we didn't bring them either. But we captured a couple, a 60 mortar right there in the center of the island. But there was no effective fire from that because we couldn't even set it up.
Okay, so
basically, it was just the machine guns attached out, and everybody, my rocket launcher guys were just carrying M16s.
Got it. So you guys are essentially, as the graphic on the map kind of shows, you guys are essentially in a 180 with your flanks bent back to the beach, and you pushed
in. We're basically in a horseshoe position with the water and the beach to our back and the enemy to our front and no place to go.
How far between you and the enemy? Hand grenade range?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And we're blasting them and they're blasting us. There was one radio call early on that I heard of it. There were 70. They said there were 79 enemy dead. I don't know who was saying that, but there was a whole bunch of crap going on over the place.
Okay,
we got several wounded, and we're taking care of the wounded, but they're all patched up and fighting as well.
Okay, what about the heavy weapons that were getting shot at you? What was it? 12.7 machine guns, heavy machine guns. What was getting shot?
Heavy machine guns. There were any machine guns comparable to our 30 cal or 50 cal, or 14, I don't remember the numbers, 12.7 or something.
Yep.
They had green tracers, which was amazing to watch after it got dark. It was, when we extracted, I'll tell that later, but,
okay.
Yeah, but there was, there had to be half a dozen of these heavy machine guns.
Okay, so that's the situation that you guys sit in after this first wave of Marines comes in.
Right.
Okay.
And then the last helicopter came in at 9:30, and we did not get any reinforcements until 12:30 that afternoon. It took 2 hours for the helicopters to go back to Nepal, and then another 2 hour trip to return to the island. The helicopters are getting shot up and full of holes and, having problems. The plan was for the entire Echo Company and part of Fox to be brought in on the second wave, and instead of 9 or 10 helicopters, it ended up with 3. So you're seeing the problem with logistics already. But that was at the 12:30 reinforcements.
Okay.
So anyway, we're trying to hook up a command element, and we're taking fire. There was one KIA, and then we had, we're moving, I brought everybody back into the perimeter, and then we started going along the tree line right along the water line. It wasn't any beach, it was all rocks and crap. We hugged the shoreline and kept going south, where the fire was in front of us, and we, after a couple hundred yards, we came up on a big log bunker, and I said, guys, we've got to take this bunker. I'm going to crawl up as close as I can and throw a hand grenade, and then let's just get up and assault through it and set up a perimeter on the other side. And everybody looks at me, and I start crawling down the beach. It was a bit of a downhill situation with the sand, so they couldn't hit me with the fire from the bunker. And I got close enough, and I stood up and threw the grenade. Luckily, it went right where it was supposed to go and blew up, and then the Marines just charged right through right behind me and set up the perimeter, and we captured this bunker. The Marines, these young kids were so damn good. They all did exactly what they were supposed to do. The Marine training all kicked in. Can't say enough about how great they were. Inside this bunker were three KIAs, a shitload of ammunition, including more hand grenades in these plastic bags, a lot of, I called it M79 grenade launcher, loop gun, 20mm, the same as in the M203. Another big plastic bag with 70, 80 rounds, it's just hanging there on like a peg on one of the upright braces of the hooch. But also inside there was a 90mm U.S. Army anti-tank gun. At first I called it a 106 because it looked like our 106 recoilless rifles we had at the time, but it was actually a 90. Somebody tried to say afterwards it was a 70, but before we extracted, we had a Marine engineer to put a thermite grenade down the barrel, and we watched it melt. And the size of the thermite grenade, you couldn't put it in a 50, so it had to be a 90mm. But it had about 25 rounds in these wooden tubes with Chinese writing on it. But it was aimed out at the beach. If anybody had tried to make an amphibious landing on that little beach, it would have blasted the hell out of them. So anyway, we captured this bunker. There was another radio in there, the same radio as we were using. And it was on our frequency, and they had been listening to us, which amazed me. But after we captured the bunker, I'm sitting there, and then the battalion command element had worked their way up slowly towards us, and we got relieved there on that position. He says, hold here till you're relieved. And he said, I did a good job. And then they went back to inside the perimeter. Right at that time, the second wave of helicopters is coming in, and I'm on this radio, and the helicopter pilot is saying, is the beach secure? Is the beach secure? And nobody's saying anything. And I know we've got to get these guys in. We need the reinforcements. We're out of water. It was 100 degrees. Everybody was dehydrated like crazy. And we need ammo and everything else to get the wounded out. And the pilot says, well, LZ secure. And there was all these majors and everybody else around with radios and crap, but I said, LZ secure, come on in. And I looked at my watch, and that was 12:30. And then that's when we got the reinforcements. Again, one of the helicopters was shot up so bad, he touched down, but he didn't offload any Marines. So we got more Marines back in our reinforcement. At that point, one of the Echo Company platoon lieutenants came out and reinforced me on that position, and they pulled us back, and we actually had a little parade going back down the beach to get into the perimeter, and I went first, and I had the dog tags of the one KIA we had, and then four guys carrying him and a poncho, and we actually brought the 90mm anti-tank gun with us. We didn't want to leave it there. It was three or four guys carrying the tripod and another five or six carrying the barrel. They were real excited about that. We worked our way back there, and we worked our way back down and got into the perimeter and stayed in the perimeter until we were extracted.
All right, Dan, question for you. When you say one KIA, that was one KIA on the West Beach, and the total?
Ashton M. Looney, Ashton M. Looney, a Lance Corporal.
Okay, and but there was how many were killed in the first wave that was shot down on East Beach?
That would have been 13.
Okay. All right. I just so people understand.
One of the air crew on the helicopter that crashed in the water off West Beach was a KIA also.
Got it.
The other helicopters got those out. But that was the KIAs at that point. So we got back in the perimeter, and that's when I met Captain Davis again. He had actually gone back to Utapau, where the helicopter had limped back and crashed in Thailand. They got picked up by the other helicopters from the first wave, took him back to Thailand. He immediately pulled somebody off the Echo Company helicopter that was going to come back in, and he went back to the island. And I gave him Rooney's dog tag and told him what had been going on. And then I found out then that the Mayaguez crew had actually been recovered. He had never even been on the island. Again, faulty, horrible intelligence. They were aboard a Thai fishing boat, and as soon as the bomb started landing, the Khmer Rouge told them to go get out of here, and early in the afternoon they took that Thai fishing boat back, and then they were picked up by the Holt on the east side of the island. So the crew saved, and now you got 127 Marines on this island under heavy fire, trying to figure out what we're going to do. We didn't come to plant the flag and capture territory, so instead of being the rescuers, now we needed to be rescued off this island.
Okay, and just so everybody knows, you already said that in Delta Company 1-4 that was with you, they had already landed on the Mayaguez. The Mayaguez had been originally towed by the Holt or the Wilson,
right.
and then they got it underway. And so
they had six members of the Merchant Marine that landed with the Marines, and they got the ship started underway, and then it took off. Then the Holt came back into the operation.
Okay, so just to paint the broader picture now, the Mayaguez is underway. The crew that was never on Koh Tang Island has been recovered, and now it's the Marines that are on this island in their own shit sandwich, facing hundreds of Cambodian Marines themselves, and now to try to deal with that. But the good news is, in that second wave, that 12:30 wave, Captain Davis shows up. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And he had his shit together. He was really good. We got walked around the perimeter, double checked the machine guns and everything else. Colonel Austin was there, and was standing there trying to figure out what we're going to do. And then all of a sudden there's this C-130 flying overhead, and we notice something being pushed out of the back end on a pallet with a parachute. And they're saying, well, if that's our resupply, it's not even close to us. The enemy's going to get that. We need the water and the ammo over here. Why are they dropping it over there? And then all of a sudden a huge explosion. Unbeknownst to anybody in the battalion, some Air Force clown has decided, well, we want to get in the operation. We've been playing around. We'll drop this ELU-82 Daisy Cutter bomb, the largest weapon in the U.S. ordnance at the time. Like the mother of all bombs they dropped later, this was the biggest thing. It was actually used to clear landing fields in the jungles of Vietnam. They dropped the bomb, and then it would blast a big circle area where you could actually land helicopters. Then it was the nickname for it was the Daisy Cutter. Anyway, we're standing there and almost get blown over. The island shakes, huge fire and smoke, and for about the next 15-20 minutes, everything was quiet. The enemy didn't fire anything. We didn't fire anything. It was quiet as it was all day. But that didn't last that long.
What the hell? What the hell was it like to be within a few hundred yards of that thing? Holy shit!
I had a piece of shrapnel from it, about the size of 3/4 stacked up. It literally bounced off my boot. I went to pick it up and I burnt my hand. It was still so hot. But I'm lucky I didn't get wounded. I had another piece of shrapnel that went in the magazine of my M16, but I didn't get wounded. But it was heavy duty, and the island literally shook. The impression it made on the island was so deep that years later it actually became a fresh water source for the island, and it didn't have one before, and we still could see the big hole. But you would have thought that somebody would have told somebody, hey, get your guys down, we're going to drop this. But no, they didn't do that.
That's normally how it works. You and I both know. When we draw it up, when we do it, I'll tell you what, I've seen the same thing happen in Afghanistan with special forces units. They're working inside your battle space and they get in a shit sandwich and they drop a 1,000-pound bomb in proximity to somebody and all of a sudden every radio net in the world lights up. What the hell was that? But that's a 1,000 pounds. What you're talking about is being a couple hundred meters away from 15,000 pounds. It's amazing to hear that. Amazing to hear that. And you thought it was a resupply, yes? That's what. It comes down on a pallet.
They push it out of the back end of a C-130, and it's on a pallet, and the pallet drops,
right.
And then the bomb is lowered by a parachute. So it was strange looking, but it was interesting.
All right, Jim. We're gonna take a quick break here. And, my guest today, very graciously, is Dan Hoffman. Were you a second lieutenant at this time or first lieutenant, Dan?
Yeah, second lieutenant.
Second lieutenant in, Weapons Platoon, Golf Company, 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines on Koh Tang Island. Graciously, volunteered to be our battle study, for today. We'll take a quick break. More of that coming up next on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, we continue. Battlefield study today is about Koh Tang Island, and we're talking about with one of the gentlemen that was there that day, Second Lieutenant Dan Hoffman, and very gracious enough to give up his time and do this for us. And Dan, I can't say thank you enough. I just personally for me, I love listening to these accounts and the lessons you can learn and hopefully there's going to be a lot of people that listen to this and a lot of people that take notes and learn from this. And I know that's your goal as well. But again, thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure. My pleasure. When we first started Koh Tang Myagras Veterans Organization, the goal was to get the word out about this operation. For a long time, it was just a footnote. The last battle of the Vietnam War, and hardly anybody knew about it at all. So we appreciate you helping us get the word out.
No, lots to learn from this, and even though it was almost 50 years ago, still as much to be learned now as there was then. All right, it's about what 12:30. The second wave has come in. The Daisy cutter has been dropped, and so walk us through the rest of your afternoon.
Well, the Myagras have been recovered, their crew has been rescued, and now the Marines are on the island. They've got to figure out what they're going to do with us. There was no way to get more reinforcements to us, and they had to figure out, are we going to spend the night on the island, or are we going to try and go for an extraction? The decision was made that if we were going to be extracted, it had to be all or nothing. The last thing they wanted to have happen, the worst thing they could have done, was get us down to 30 or 40 Marines left on the island in the dark, and then not be able to get them off, because those certainly would have been overrun. So the 20 Marines and the 5 Air Force that were isolated on East Beach, once the command and control was done with the male call sign, the OB-10 Bronco, they had a much better operation and ability to, with fire support, suppressing the enemy and their positions. You mentioned briefly in the beginning Henry D. Wilson. One of the things they did, they were mostly on the West Beach, but they had their 5-inch gun was actually being called in for fire support on the northern end of the island, and that was very effective. But they took the captain's gig, a small little boat off the side of this small destroyer escort, brass railings and the white ropes and everything shiny and clean. It was basically used for hauling mail and officers and small amounts of supplies back and forth when they were in port. They took the captain's gig, and they had half a dozen sailors that had been in the brown water navy in Vietnam, and they took M60 machine guns, didn't have any mounts. They actually had slings on, and they strapped them on, and strapped it down. And they were using this captain's gig, Black Velvet 1 was their call sign. Black Velvet was the Wilson, the Black Velvet 1 was this little captain's gig. And they were extremely effective. They got in close and they had direct fire with machine guns. They'd draw the fire and then naval, the OB-10 Bronco would get better fire support. And he also had, at that point, Spectre, spooky gunships with their tremendous firepower, and they blasted the shit out of a bunch of stuff. So things were turning our way.
Okay, one note I had written that I wanted to ask you about. When the second wave's en route, as they get close, there was some discussion that, or they were ordered by somebody to turn around and not insert. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it was determined that the crew had been rescued, so we didn't need any more Marines on the island. I didn't hear it, but I actually have friends that swear they heard Henry Kissinger's voice with the accent issuing orders. And there was a big dispute about who was going to do what. Our battalion commander, Colonel Austin, insisted we had to have those guys that we're getting the shit kicked out of us here, and we need reinforcements, we need help. And they circled around and went back and forth for a while, but then they finally brought him in, which was very beneficial to us in the early afternoon.
Got it. All right. Forgive me for butting in, but I thought I can't imagine hearing.
Oh, there's so many side stories. It's ridiculous.
Right. Right. Okay. All right.
So then we're going to start with the extraction.
Well, let me. You mentioned the OB-10 checked on. About what time did the OB-10 check on, and what difference did those guys make? And first of all, do you know who that was? Was he ever a part of your association? Because
Bob Undorf is his name, and he saved the day. He saved many, many lives that day.
Because he checks in and he starts organizing the ground, and you finally have some semblance of an organized Marine, Navy, Air Force effort now on this island, because you got plenty of fire support. You're just not able to talk to them, and nobody's got it. Nobody's doing the command and control thing that the Air Force, battle staff is supposed to do. And then Undorf, he checks in and he begins to do it.
Yeah, save the day. Sure got a huge medal, but he took off and went to the island without orders, and the same Brigadier General that decided they didn't need them was upset with them, so I think he got like an Air Force commendation medal, which is absurd. But that Brigadier General got fired, so I guess it worked out. Anyway, with his excellent fire support, we were able to clean the situation up a bit. The problem was earlier that we had these M4 Phantom jets going a million miles an hour wanting to drop ordnance, and we're all spread out all over the place, and I did a lot more time having the guys on station abort their runs rather than direct them, because they were all, they'd flown from wherever they had flown, and they wanted to, drop something so they were part of the operation, but it was just no way to really identify where our lines were, and there weren't. You mentioned General Joel McMinniman earlier, the 81st Platoon Commander.
Mm-hmm.
Before the command element had linked up, he had set up two of his troops and trying to clear the way so that they could advance further north. And they actually were, the 81s were coming on my position. And I'm on the radio with Joe McMinniman cussing them out and saying, knock this shit off and everything. But it was funny at the time. Afterward, it was funny. But our own 81s were blasting us. The extraction was going to be an issue because all the helicopters had been shot up. The thing that changed the day was the USS Coral Sea. It had been steaming at full speed for a day trying to get closer and closer. And in the middle of the afternoon, they were about 45 minutes away. So the decision was made with the helicopters. They were going to fly to the Coral Sea and do a turnaround to come back fast and get the Marines off the island, as opposed to the 2 hours back to the Palau Island and back again.
Okay, now you have to tell everybody the Coral Sea doesn't exist anymore, so tell everybody what the Coral Sea was.
It was an aircraft carrier, a big aircraft carrier. The fighter planes had been coming in early on. And it's racing like hell to get to us. And as the afternoon goes on, it's 40 minutes away, it's a half hour away. And when I was finally extracted, it was 20 minutes away, so it helped quite a bit. The shot-up helicopters from the first wave landed on there, and the Navy guys were trying to patch them up so they could fly back and extract us again, because, of course, there was no other helicopters to do it, no other assets at all. And one of the things, there was a fuel line in one of the 53s that was shot up bad, kind of like a metal tube, think of a brake line on a car, whatever.
Right.
So these Navy chiefs, they patched it up with a plastic hose and hose clamps and sent it back into combat. Some safety officer would have had a fit and said, this bird can't fly, but they did it, and they brought Save Marines because they did that. Everybody was doing everything they could to make this operation work.
Amazing. The let's talk about, there's a decision that your battalion commander, what's Lieutenant Colonel Austin is his name, yes?
Randy W. Austin, yes.
He's faced with a decision in mid-afternoon. Do we spend the night there, or do we try, or do we extract? Talk about that decision.
Well, they finally got the guys off East Beach, in part because of the command and control with the airborne OV-10 Broncos. They brought helicopters in that had been shot up after two or three went out of commission. They got shot up so bad trying to get in there. But once they had the Spectre and the captains gave off the Wilson and everything else, they were finally able to extract those guys off of there with their wounded, and they got out of there. So then all we had was the Marines on the West Beach. And the situation was, we had a pretty good perimeter, and we're dug in deep. I mean, guys have been digging their positions all day long. And we were all right. We had plenty of ammo, no short on food and water, but everything else was okay. We'd have been fine to spend the night except for the 300 or 400 Khmer Rouge in front of us. So the decision was made, if they're going to extract us, they had to be all or nothing, because they didn't want to get it down to 30 or 40 Marines left by themselves, 20 Marines, one last helicopter, whatever, and then have them overrun and have more deaths. So it was all or nothing, and they decided, all right, we're going to try to get everybody out of here, with the help of the fact that they could go to a Coral Sea. That was part of the decision at that point, too.
Okay, and then there's there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about. One of the other things I read in terms of fire support was the use of CS gas on the island. Did you guys mask up? Did it have no effect on you?
They dropped gas on the Mayaguez before the assault in the beginning when they put the troops from 1-4 on it. And that cloud came out over the island, but it wasn't really affected by the time we got there at 7 o'clock.
Got it.
The first wave, and the guys on the East Beach might have had a little bit more of a problem with it.
Okay. All right. All right, got it. Go ahead. Continue.
So we're talking, trying to figure out what's going on. Yeah, we're going to get out of here, and all of a sudden three helicopters show up, again, with no coordination, and the battalion commander says, all right, let's get out of here. Echo Company, go first. So the two platoons, a platoon and a half, whatever it was, from Echo Company, loads up on the plane, and they charge in. In the morning when the helicopters had landed, they had landed on the strip of beach, the beach sand, but the tide had come in, and now there was almost no place to land, so the guys were going out waist-deep in the water as the helicopters got one wheel on the beach and the other wheel in the water and or hovering above the water, whatever, and it was difficult to get in there, but they raced and got 30, 40 guys in the first helicopter. And then Colonel Austin says to Captain Davis said to Colonel Austin, so you're in the morning, I got here late this afternoon. I'll do the night shift and get everybody out here. So Colonel Austin and all the battalion staff extracted on like the second helicopter. And that was like the first wave out, and they're going to Coral Sea, which is like 30 minutes away. So it's starting to get dark, and we're drawing our perimeter in. And all of these great positions that the guys have dug and been in all day, they're leaving those positions and crawling back, and we're making the perimeter smaller. Still, it's basically a horseshoe shape with a half moon shape with the water to our back and no place to go. And as we are moving back, the enemy's crawling forward and then taking over our positions. That's the positions we have, so things were getting a little bit hairier then. And everything, basically, it's continuous fire the whole time. It was just solid machine gun fire and M16 fire all day long, with the exception, I said, let me drop that daisy cutter. It was quiet for several minutes after that. But, and then when the helicopters would come in, it would just be three times as much. And once dark was there, you could see the tracers on the machine gun, and the communists made whatever they were, machine guns were, had green tracers, which I had never seen before. But then when we knew their positions, then the Obi-10 Broncos would get fire on them. So,
okay. You know, so it's about, about 18:30 at night as the first extract goes. What fire support are you using now that the sun's going down? Because, it gets a little bit dicier once the sun goes down. What is anything suppressing? And Dan, could you describe what kind of position are the cameras? Are they all dug in? Are they all dug in?
Yeah, it was dense jungle. We really couldn't see them.
Okay.
Most guys never even saw the enemy that day. It was just really thick, dense jungle and elephant grass. So you could see the tracer rounds or the muzzle flash where they were shooting from. But it was rare earlier in the day even when someone got a good shot on somebody standing up or moving or whatever where they could actually see the enemy. And the three KIAs I had in that bunker was the first time I'd actually seen one myself.
Wow.
And we'd been fighting for hours. We're pulling back, and three helicopters leave. And then we're waiting, and then another one comes in. And another helicopter had come on station. It had been at another base further north in Thailand, and maintenance crews had been working around the clock to try to bring it up. And they gave it to another junior first lieutenant pilot. And most of these pilots, by the way, just brought these helicopters in, and there's heavy fire, and just planted them there, sat there, took this fire, and then took off and got these Marines out of there, and then came back for another one. The Air Force was just so heroic. There were three Air Force crosses, second to the Medal of Honor, awarded that day to pilots. Colonel Austin says, Dan, you get out in this next helicopter. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. When reading different accounts of this, one of the things that literally takes your breath away is the courage of these air crews and hanging in there and doing their part. I mean, let me tell you, they fly like Marines fly, and they stick their nose in there, come back around. Interestingly enough, though, Dan, you said they weren't used to kind of flying the way Marines fly, which would be nap of the earth and then flare and then set down real quick. That simply was not the way they flew. So they had their own.
There was no procedure. There was no training. They had never worked with Marines at all. One of the units was an aerospace recovery unit. They were the ones that picked up the Gemini space capsules out of the Pacific. That's what they were trained for. And then they were, they rescued pilots with a PJ and a hook behind the enemy lines in Vietnam with pilots that were shot down. But they did not do anything offensive at all. So it was amazing the things that they pulled off.
Wow. Okay, so you get... Well,
let me tell you about my helicopter pilot. So, to catch my breath here, I get emotional. So, Colonel Austin says to me, all right, Dan, you get out on this next one. I said, I can stay a little longer. He says, no, you go. All right. So, we're racing to load up on the helicopter. The ramp is down, and I'm crawling through the water, and I'm so exhausted from the whole day that I can barely crawl up this ramp waist deep. And I'm one of the last ones on. There's 37 Marines on this helicopter. 25 is the maximum combat load for safety, so that tells you how overloaded we were to try to get everybody out of there. And there's two helicopters to go behind me. or the group that left me. So I'm on what's called Jolly 44. First Lieutenant Bob Blau is the pilot, about a year and a half out of the Air Force Academy.
Okay, can you paint the picture of how many Marines are then left once you stagger onto that ramp and before you tell the rest of your story? How many, and so they're shrinking their perimeter, night's falling, about how many Marines are left after you hop on Blau's 53?
Somewhere around 40, okay. Maybe 45. Most of the wounded have been gotten out, but again, people are getting wounded all through the whole thing.
So, right.
There were 60 Purple Hearts given out that day.
Wow.
With 127 on the island. A lot of shrapnel wounds, because of the heavy grenades. And the enemy had mortars. They had everything. But, so I get in this helicopter and, we're taking off and it's under heavy fire. And like I say, you can see all these tracers. And there's like green lines and red lines from the various, tracers with the American guns that they had captured and they're using. I mean, Russian made or Chinese made, whatever. And for a second I said, boy, this is pretty. It's like Christmas. And then I realized, hell, they're shooting at us. So we got out of there and I'm sitting on the far end of the helicopter and ramp. It is pitch dark. No moon, overcast, no starlight, nothing, but I could see the waves below us. And we, are patting each other on the back. We made it. We got out of there. Everybody's good. We had a couple of wounded and the Air Force PJ was treating them in the back of the helicopter. And, they had a mount-out box with ice in it. They apologized to the enemy drinks for us, but we're all digging our filthy hands with the dirt just dripping off of it into this mount-out box, grabbing ice, because we had no water all day. I ran out like 10 o'clock in the morning. And we're just chewing on this ice. It's the best ice I ever had, remember that. So we're settling down to ride this helicopter to the Coral Sea, which is about 20 minutes away. And reflecting on what was going on and looking, you know, the wounded and this and that, whatever. And all of a sudden, the helicopter starts to shake and vibrate, and it's going left and right, moving around and shaking quite a bit. And I'm looking out the back of the ramp, and I can see the water getting closer and closer. Like I said, it was pitch dark, really, really dark. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, the helicopter's going in the water. We're going to crash in the water. So I start telling the guys by me, you know, take your helmet off, take your flak jacket off. And it keeps moving and adjusting and vibrating and this and that. And then all of a sudden, the guy grabs me.
Dan, are there those seats in this helicopter, or are you guys on the floor?
We're on the floor.
Okay.
There's a minigun on the back end, and I suppose there were some kind of, I don't know what you would call it, but some kind of cloth seat that would fold down, but it was not for transporting troops.
Okay.
We're just sitting on the middle of the floor.
Got
and
it.
In fact, when we took off, there was a problem. We had too many on the ass end, and they had to push a bunch of guys forward so we could fly level. But we're taking the Coral Sea's another 15 minutes away, and we're going in the water, and the ship's vibrating. But then somebody grabbed me and started pushing me up towards the front of the helicopter, and there's an exit door right behind the pilot seat. Kind of like when you see the president coming off of the White House and the steps are there. And I'm ready to jump off and jump in the water, and instead I land on the deck of a Navy ship. And all of a sudden there's this guy with a little flashlight and red lights and one of those cloth helmets on with earphones on, steering us, and they push us into the bulk of the ship. Come to find out, we had landed on the Harold E. Holt. It was called the Destroyer Escort at the time. They changed it to the Fast Frigate. But it's basically the smallest ocean-going vessel in the Navy. It had a 5-inch gun up front and a very small helipad on the back end. It would normally land like a 2-seat helicopter for resupply and such. But this Lieutenant Bob Blau had landed this huge HH-53, which is a very big helicopter and his very small helipad, to do that. Now, understand the ship is underway, and the ship's going up and down and left and right with the waves and the wind, and it's totally dark. He had to push the nose of the helicopter into this square helipad in the right front corner. His left wheels was in the left front corner. His right wheels was in the right rear corner, And when I was at the ramp of the helicopter, it was hanging off over the ship so far, I couldn't even see the ship. All I could see was water. The helicopter was so heavy, he couldn't land it. He actually had to do, and I'm not a pilot, I don't know all the proper terms, but he had to keep 50% power on the wheels, so he's touched down, but he hasn't really landed. He's still flying the helicopter. The problem is, the ship is going forward, and he's flying this helicopter forward at a 45-degree angle. And it was just the most amazing feat of flying. I tell the story to people, and experienced pilots are listening to it with their mouth open. I've seen pictures of Chinooks and other helicopters in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're picking up wounded, and they land the put the ramp down on a little stone building or whatever. But the helicopter, the stone building's not moving, and that was in daylight. So we offload our 37 Marines, several of whom were wounded, and then this lieutenant takes off, and right away he goes right back into the fray, into heavy fire, and picks up another 38 Marines off the beach.
Okay, and then, let me just, who instructed him to go to the hold?
That was his idea. That was his idea. They had to do crazy things and try to get things done. He got a Silver Star for his actions, and we thought he should have got the Congressional, but his superiors were less than thrilled at his daring do, if you will, and they only gave him a Silver Star, but he still was a huge hero that day.
Wow.
And then, like I say, he went back in for another heavy load of Marines, but he had taken water and intakes and more machine gun damage and such. They asked him if he was going to go back to the hold. He says, I'm not crazy enough to do that again. And then he flew off to the coral.
There was the two helos that were ahead of you on that extract. And so how many helicopters are still flyable when Lieutenant Blau is doing his thing on the hold? Is he the only one that can fly? Are the other ones not?
No, there was like three.
There's
and the
three.
Other two are going back and forth from the hold. There was another Navy helicopter that had some machine guns that were M-16s out the windows of the helicopter. They were providing a little bit of fire support, but they couldn't. They didn't land or try to kick anybody off. But the 53s had heavy guns, and they had a minigun on each side and a minigun in the back. So they had some heavy firepower, which was very effective. But no, the two took off for the Coral Sea, and then Bob Blau came in for his first load, and then there was one load. He went back for his second load because he was able to do a quick turnaround by going to the hold. And then after his second extract, there was one helicopter left on the ground. So the guys had pulled their perimeter back even tighter, and they can hear the waves lapping behind them, and they can hear the enemy crawling forward. But the Spectre gunships, which had the infrared such, they were blasting the hell out of everything in front of them. And it comes down to the last helicopter in, and they're loading up everybody on it. Captain Davis and Gunny McNamara, our company gunnery sergeant, are last one on there with Wayne Fisk, was the PJ parajumper on the helicopter crew. He was actually the last one on the island. And they load them up in the helicopter, and they get them out of there under heavy fire, and then they go to the Coral Sea. And that supposedly is the end of the operation. And that was about 7:30 at night. And like I say, from the first moment the battalion got the word to go in Okinawa until the last helicopter took off was less than 48 hours. But then something terrible happened. Apparently, in the confusion of the extraction, unbeknownst to any of us, a machine gun team of three Marines that belonged to Echo Company, not our company, not Gulf Company, not Captain Davis Command, But the ones that pulled out, and there's still daylight almost, had somehow been left on the far southern end of the perimeter. We didn't get the word. Somebody told them to stay, and they didn't, or should have, or not, or what. But everything had been messed up because they didn't know where everybody was at.
Right.
They had taken wounded back to Utapau. There was wounded aboard two different naval ships, three ships with the Coral Sea. We had Marines on the Holt, and on the guys that were picked up at sea were on the Wilson and Coral Sea. So they did several head counts and was finally determined that we were missing three Marines, Marshall, Hargold, and Hall, were their last names. And the word that was passed, we were told, was that they had to have been killed by grenades or whatever before or during the extraction, otherwise they wouldn't have stayed there, and they would have risked to get on the helicopter or the last helicopter or whatever. But I chose to believe, and most of us, I guess, thought the case was that they had to have been killed in the extraction. We went back. We were there the next day. We were. They had ships going up and down, hailing to try to get them to call out or swim out. Apparently, none of them were swimless, and nothing was said or done. They were supposed to go in with the Navy SEAL team that night or the next morning. Somebody had said you got to go in under a white flag. And the lieutenant JG said, I'm not taking my guys in there on the white flag. We want to go in the dark, you know. And I had been a scuba diver, a civilian diver. I did not have military training at all, but I knew where Looney's body was on the beach. And I was on a bridge of the Holt, and there was discussion about whether I would go back in if I might help with the higher levels. It never happened, but I was ready to go if they needed it. But we cruised around the island the next day. There were helicopters everywhere, and nothing was ever said or done, and then we went home, and that was it. And we all went about our business and rotated. We had to go through our training back in at Camp Schwab. We were the only combat-tested unit in the entire U.S. Military, the only ones that have been in combat since Vietnam had ended with regular combat about 2 years earlier. So we thought we were pretty hot shit. And we had to go back to Okinawa to actually get the rest of our training so we could qualify to be the battalion afloat so we could be used in an effort of an event of something like that that we had already done. We thought that was pretty common.
Hey, man, somebody's got to sign off on that stuff. And unless you hit all the wickets, just because you fought a little bit doesn't mean you get out of the rest of this stuff. Come on, get with the program.
Anyway.
Wow. No, it is. It's crazy. And a lot of, you know, it's interesting, Dan. A lot of guys don't, you know, the chicken shit, you know, part of life, you know, when you come back to a non-combat environment, a lot of guys don't have a lot of patience for that after they experience getting shot up.
Yeah. So I rotated back to the States the following year. We did our six-month float,
right.
And I did. And we went to Camp Fuji in Korea for 30 days, and then we the Philippines and a couple other Liberty ports. But we had our six-month deployment. And then we started to rotate back to the States. I went back to camp in June, and was a rifle company XO for Echo 2-6. I reported in wearing a combat action ribbon and a National Defense Medal. That's all I had. That's all I rated at the time. And I got a whole bunch of flack. Why aren't you wearing the rest of your ribbons? Like I was supposed to get on war in this thing. And as I explained, it was about 6 months later that we got the Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal and the Navy Unit Commendation, and then I got a Bronze Star with me about a month after that. But for a while there, it was funny. Just all I had was the combat action. We had another lieutenant buddy of mine. This teacher school class was behind my just a couple months. And for whatever reason, there was a cutoff date. He didn't even rate the National Defense Medal, but he had the Purple Heart, so he's going around with just a Purple Heart.
He probably got stopped more than a few times. Hey, you, come here. What are you doing?
Well, that was Jim McDaniel, the one that got the Navy Cross. So we didn't give him a shit. But I had a good time, and I enjoyed my time in the Marine Corps. As a first lieutenant, I did lead floats with 2-6, and then I volunteered and did a Carib float as the adjutant for 38th Mile. They still had Marine amphibious units, and we did amphibious landing with Brazilian Marines in Vieques. That was cool.
Right.
But I got out after I was trying to get augmented, but I got a 2-year extension, so I had 4 years and 10.5 months active duty. After Vietnam, this is surprising, at that time frame, Carter was cutting back the Marine Corps extensively, and I was trying to get augmented. I had the medal, and I had letters from other guys, but if you were in Vietnam and you wanted to get augmented, all you had to have was get a regular commission in the Marine Corps, is what augmented me. All you had to do was have 10 fingers and 10 toes, and that could be waived. So I'm trying to pick up captain, and there are hundreds of captains who are not going to make major that went to high quality or whatever, and they're getting passed over, but they still have their billets, and I couldn't buy
right.
Getting a regular commission.
Right,
as the Marine Corps
shrinks back down to normal peacetime Marine Corps. The we're gonna transition here and talk about life after the Marine Corps here in a second, but I want to talk about lessons learned from the operation itself, Dan. I mean, you have had a long time to think about it. So when you look, if you were giving advice to young leaders, what are the lessons that you draw from your experience on Koh Tang Island?
You've got to be prepared for anything, and you've got to expect that it can and will happen. I remember sitting in the basic school in class and maybe not giving 100% when I could have and should have on something that was interesting to me. You know, if we were firing weapons or something, that would have been fun. But if we're learning land nav or something legal or whatever, I probably didn't give it 100%. But I found myself... We didn't expect to go in. We had no intention. Our understanding, the war was over. We weren't supposed to go into battle. And all of a sudden, there I am, under heavy fire, calling in the four Phantom jets for airstrikes. And I know I didn't use the proper terminology or the proper order of words or instruction, but we got some warnings where we needed it. When the shit hit the fan, you got to do what you got to do. But study and be prepared and... give her all you can. The intelligence was horrible. We had horrible, horrible intelligence. The command and control, the radios, you couldn't talk to anybody else. There was no coordination between anything. An Air Force colonel shouldn't be telling the Marine lieutenant colonel how to move his troops. Some S-3 Alpha back on Okinawa shouldn't be telling you how to do things in the middle of battle. The ground commander has got to be in charge, even if he's only a first lieutenant. But he's got to be in charge and make the decision because he knows what's happening in front of him. The weapons were good. Our Marines were good. Our equipment was sufficient. But we weren't prepared. We didn't have any water. The guys got camelbacks and all that stuff. Now we had 2 plastic canteens, and that went fast. You can't overextend and go too far if you don't have the support for it. The Air Force guys were just magnificent. Can't say enough about their heroism getting us out of there under heavy, heavy fire. But they didn't know how to load Marines or land helicopters on them. The first wave came in, circled around again, then landed, then turned into the wind, and then lowered their ramp. You can't do that under heavy fire. But they didn't know any better. They'd never trained. Second or third wave didn't do it that way, but yeah, there was no rapid deployment force. There was no cross-training. The Navy guys didn't know what the Marines were doing, and the Marines didn't know what the Air Force was doing, and vice versa. But we all made it happen and all made it work at the end. But there were too many casualties. As I said, the last 41 names on the memorial are from May of 1975 and the Koh Tang Michael Declaration. Those were the real heroes that day, the ones we salute. And that includes the three that were left behind.
All right.
Well, I can talk about PTSD now if you want to.
Yep, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to transition here. We're going to talk about the aftermath. Again, I think everybody who listens to the program understands the mission of All Marine Radio is post-combat-related mental health. And so we talk about it today. When Dan got done with his time in the Marine Corps, there was no mention, there was no diagnosis. There was certainly nothing like All Marine Radio or the discussion that goes on very publicly about post-traumatic stress. So don't touch that dial. We're going to talk about that next. My guest, former First Lieutenant, United States Marine Corps. Did you get out first? Did you ever make captain before you got out, Dan?
I got out November 27th. January 4th, I would have made captain.
Former captain selectee, which means he was a First Lieutenant, United States Marine Corps recipient of the Bronze Star with the Combat V, Dan Hoffman, graciously joining us. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs at allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event, farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. BattleMug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoffoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Our fifth battlefield study installment talks about Koteng Island and the SS Mayaguez and the rescue of the crew, and the liberation of the ship, and the exploits of Marines from Echo and Golf Company and the command element of 2nd Battalion 9th Marines. And our guest, very graciously, is former Marine Corps First Lieutenant, Captain Select, Dan Hoffman. Dan, talk to us about the aftermath. We didn't have any mental health services. Were you able? I mean, so the technique was stuff it away in the closet, don't go near the door. Talk to us about the aftermath and how you dealt with the things that you saw.
Post Vietnam. Nobody talked about their military experience. When I got out after my almost 5 years, everybody grew a beard and their hair long, because we had stood out for so long with the high and tights. And you didn't talk about anything. I went for years without seeing other Marines or talking about Marine Corps stuff at all. I may have had a Marine Corps sticker on my car, but there was almost nothing. I remember one time, probably 10 years after the operation, I'd been out, for whatever reason, I was in watching a parade, and, a Marine Corps lead detachment went by. And I had not even seen any Marines. So I'm standing up, jumping and hollering, what for them? And, the other people I was with didn't even know I had been in the Marines. So after about 20 years, literally. We had just stuffed it and didn't talk about it. A strong anti-war feeling and movement after Vietnam, the baby killers and everything else. So you didn't talk about your military experience and certainly didn't share it with others. But for like 20 years, I hardly did anything. And then a book came out in 1995. Identifying the possibility that the three Marines from the Echo Company machine gun had actually been left alive on the island and captured and tortured and eventually killed. And that just drove me over the edge. I had PTSD at the time. I was drinking and fighting and having difficulties. Never done anything bad enough to end up in jail, but I was close. But when I found out about this, I did some investigating and more reading and checking into things, and, obviously it weighed very heavily on me that we left these three guys alive on the island, and Marines don't do that. It never should have happened. So eventually I went to the VA hospital, and over a period of several years, I got checked in and said to be treated for PTSD. Didn't even know what it was. Didn't even know what to call it at that point in time. But the thing that was good for me was that I joined the Marine Corps League. So your audience knows what it is. It's like VFW, American Legion, but it's all Marines or Navy Corpsmen.
You bet.
And there's an event of World War II vets in your outfit, Korean vets, and I was like late 30s, and I was the youngest guy there because there were very few Vietnam guys joining. But I got into that group. And at the same time, I started through the Internet. One of the veterans of the outfit operation had contacted me and was trying to get a reunion going with several of the veterans. And we started talking and started working with people, and getting involved with other veterans was tremendous to me. At one point, the worst point of my life, I had PTSD so bad, I was laying in bed crying for a week at a time. I wouldn't do anything. I just lay around and mope. I lost my first wife and my first marriage. I was having trouble with work, drinking a lot. And once a month, on a Thursday night, I hadn't bathed or shaved or anything for 2 weeks, but I'd get cleaned up and go to the Marine Corps League meeting. And I felt like crap, and I didn't want to do anything. But I go to the Marine Corps League meeting, and the guy says, "Gee, Dan, you look great. How you doing?" And I didn't want to tell him that, you know, I'd been sitting with a handgun in my lap half a dozen days before. But the Marine Corps League and the VFW and the American Legion helped me tremendously, especially when we got with the fellow veterans of the operation itself. We started having a reunion, getting together. It's amazing working together with each other how well you can do. And I turned everything around. I checked myself into the VA hospital and I was there for a week in the beginning. I'm banging my head against the wall. But good doctors, good medicine, and good therapy. Over several years, I actually turned it around to the point where I'm now an advocate for helping other veterans get VA benefits and with PTSD. And I speak, and I do what I can with American Legion and VFW and Marine Corps League. I also got involved with PTSD therapy dogs. When I was at my worst, I had a Papillon puppy. I named him Kochang Dan, which was my nickname in the Marine Corps. My fellow lieutenants started calling me that back on Schwab, and it was a huge honor to get a combat-related nickname. But nobody ever called me that after that, but I called this little dog that. And he still is. I have him. He's 11 years old now. I'm laying on the couch crying. He'd jump on my lap, lick my face, and jump up and down and make the chicken outside and give me his ball. And he knew I was hurting, and he helped me, and he turned me around. And over the years now, I also breed and show these Papillons. A cute little lap dog, like a Chihuahua, but they got big ears and big fur. And I show them in the AKC, and I've actually had a little bit of success. I've had 3 grand champions, and I'm a breeder now. But the last few years, I started to give some of the puppies to other veterans with PTSD. They're not trained officially as a PTSD therapy dog and certified, but they act like they're so darn smart, they know what to do. And I got a brother in Kansas and a brother in Ohio right now that have them, and they just love them to death, and can't say enough. Happy on them. Very, very smart, sweet little dog.
Hey, Dan, what's the original impetus for why you joined the Marine Corps League to begin with? Was it because of the parade? What sent you in that direction to begin with?
I saw a little ad in the newspaper that said they were starting an organization. At that time, 1992, the Marine Corps League wasn't really active in my part of South Carolina where I was living. I guess it was down by Parris Island, but not in the middle of the state. So they were starting a detachment. And I figured it'd be good. I needed to get out and do some stuff and be with other guys and veterans who would understand. And I went and I joined, like I said, I was the youngest one there. There was a bunch of World War II veterans and Korean vets, but we all got along well. We started drinking and telling stories, and they took me in. And in a couple of years, I was a commandant of the organization. So it was a big turnaround. And 4 years ago now, it got to the point where I was actually a national speaker. I was the keynote speaker for the American Legion's National Convention. And I gave a half-hour speech to about 5,000 people, basically talking about the operation, like I've done with you this evening, and then also talking at the end about PTSD and how I was able to turn around and start there and become an advocate for helping others.
When you talk to other veterans that might be listening to this or might know some that are in that place, that get stuck in that place that you don't seem to be able to get yourself out of, that have a friend who might be in or near or in the vicinity of that place, what do you tell them?
Get with your fellow veterans. Get on the phone, get on the internet, find the guys you served with. There's a lot of organizations that have reunions once a year or wherever. Try to reach out to the people that would understand what you went through and where you're at. The Marine Corps League is a godsend. It's wonderful. So is the Vietnam Veterans of America. The Legion, the VFW, all of them are good. But I love the Marines, of course. And I've been a state and national officer with the Marine Corps for years, but I cannot recommend it highly enough. But it's funny, you go to these reunions and we advertise them and call people up and we've been running folks down and you get some guy that's never been in a reunion in his life. And they come in the door and they're apprehensive and they're quiet. Not sure what's going on and they kind of stand in a corner. And then somebody comes up and talks to them. And then somebody else comes up and talks to them and then they say, hey Joe, remember Fred here? And in 10 minutes, everybody's laughing and joking and telling stories. That is how they finally decided to go out and be with somebody.
And one of the things today I can tell you, I cannot emphasize enough to people what Dan is saying. And it's so much easier now to stay in touch, whether it's a Facebook page, whether it's just creating a group text with you and your best, battle buddies that you served with. And I know I communicate with five of my best friends on a daily basis. And you can tell when they're not in a good mood, right? They don't have to say a whole lot. It's by how they say what they say. And if it goes on for a few days, you wind up picking up the phone and saying, hey, man, are you all right? And invariably the answer is, no, I'm struggling right now. And so that connection, and what you go through is a bond that lasts forever. And then, I mean, how many years after the Koh Tang operation did you go to your first reunion?
It was 2003 from 1975, 28 years.
28 years. So after you walked in and sat down and the ice breaks, did it feel like you'd ever been apart?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Guys you hadn't seen, in forever. Everybody remembers everybody else. Everybody's telling stories, and then it just gets better and better. Can't emphasize it enough. It's the greatest. You really need to reach out and get involved with your brothers. The other thing, of course, is the VA. It can be a struggle. It can be a hassle. It can be difficult to get your VA benefits and get your rating. And maybe you start at 10 or 30% and then try to get up and up. I finally got to 100% over several years. And it was because another veteran said to me, he said, Dan, you, you're struggling with your work, why don't you get, you know, try to get 100% and then you can go out and help others. And that's what I did. With my disability and my retirement and such, I got to a position financially. I didn't have to worry about work. And I go to all these reunions and all these organizations and actively involved. And it's a pleasure to help others. And the guys know when somebody new comes on, and they got another brother, even Iraq in Afghanistan, that's now I'm talking to. They say, call Dan. He can talk to you. Dan can help you.
So you know, Dan, I'll tell you what,
it's extremely rewarding,
right.
And then it's helpful to me. It's beneficial to me to be able to help them, and that's what's turning my life around.
I'm a huge advocate for the Marine Corps League and for cultural reasons. I was at the VA today and. I was headed to the pharmacy. I see a guy in a wheelchair. He looks like a Vietnam era guy. He's got a First Recon Battalion hat on, Swiss Silent Deadly. And I look at him and I said, "What's up, Double Dog?" And he looks at me and he smiles, right? And he says, "Nothing." And I said, "Why don't you get out of my way then?" And he starts laughing, right? And he says, "Am I on your way?" I said, "Yeah, man, come on." And so we stand there and we talk. And I walk down the pharmacy. And then 5 minutes later, he rolls in. And he says, "Oh, not you again." And so we sit down and start talking about Vietnam, about you know, his time served. It's the warmest place in the world, culturally. I don't know this guy from Adam. And we sat and talked for close to 30 minutes. And he looked at me when we both had to leave, and he looked at me and goes, "I've talked to you more than I talked to most people in my life." And I say that because it's the warmest place in the world. But I also have another motive. The guys in the Marine Corps League, so you join where you're going to live, they can tell you about the VA. You know, you hear so many stories, "Oh, I had a bad experience with this, I had a bad experience with that." They've already done all that. They can make you smart. "Hey, go to this guy. Don't go to this guy. All right? If you need this, go see this guy. Use my name." All the shortcuts they can give you. And so, talk about that, Dan. I mean, a lot of people do this on their own, and they get really frustrated. Some of them walk away from the services that they rate forever because they get pissed and they don't want to deal with it.
Anger and frustration. You got to wait, and you got to learn to adjust and use the system, the pros and the cons, and take advantage of what you can. But like you say, get all the help you can, and there's plenty of advocates out there. Every VA office, every VA hospital's got representatives there. But the Marine Corps League always has a VAVS officer to assist you. So. Check out your veterans organization. Absolutely.
Talk to us about the dogs that you raise. You know, a lot of people will read articles about it, and will read articles about service dogs. I have two dogs. Neither one of them is a service dog, but they perform those functions for me. If I could tell you that, you know, when and I'm divorced, but I have a 14-year-old daughter. When Colleen's not here, right, and the house is empty. When I come back from doing something, you know, the two most excited creatures on the planet are Jack and Joe. And it's awesome. I'd be embarrassed to tell you how many conversations I have with those two mutts. But they are my companions. Talk about service dogs for a few minutes and your experience with them.
All right. Well, like I say, I've been breeding dogs for several years now. I'm actually sitting at a dog show now where I'm going to be showing them in the next couple of days here in Charlotte. And I get out of the car here and open up the door of the RV, and I'll have eight dogs jumping up to see me like they haven't seen me in days. First thing that happens in the morning when I wake up, I have my one dog, Kotang Dan. He's licking my face. "Yes, I love you. Yes, I know you. Yes, you're the man. You're the best dog, blah, blah, blah. We got to go through, he's got to go through his routine. And several of the others, I'm sitting there watching TV in a lazy boy, and I got five dogs in my lap. One's got to be between my legs. One's got to be with the raised legs, got to be to my left of my left leg. Not on the right, not in the middle. That's his spot. And another one will be in my lap, another sitting across the back of my shoulders. These are little dogs. They only weigh 5-6 pounds. But they're just full of heart, so smart. Cocaine Dan is a certified therapy dog. I got letters from the VA. I take him to the VA all the time. He's got his cute little vest and the Canine Good Citizen, his little patches and stuff. And I take him to reunions, and he goes and sees his vets, and he jumps up in their wheelchair and licks their face, and they all love him. Go to the VA hospital, he'll jump up in the bed with the guys. I say guys mostly, occasionally female veterans as well. But they're just so special and so loving and so caring, and they know when you're in trouble. They will they'll look out for me when I was in bad shape, and you know, checking the doors all the time, and walking the perimeter in the yard to make sure nobody's in the wire, whatever crap. He was with me, and he knows what's wrong. And if there's someone up, if I'm standing around outside and someone's coming behind me, he barks and let me know they're coming. Generally speaking, it's just emotional support, love, and appreciation, and keeping you square. He'll bring me his ball and say it's time to play. You can't sit there and do nothing. That sort of thing.
All right, final question, and then I'll let you go. You guys have a website, the Cotang Mayaguez Veterans Organization. Talk to us about that group of guys, because you know you guys didn't know each other for shit when you guys all get thrown together. And then yes. I've gone through the pictures, and I've met Air Force guys on the phone. I've seen the pictures of you guys. And that seems like obviously no small part of your life. Talk to us about that organization.
We're getting ready for a big reunion in May every year at the celebration of May 15th. We're going to be in Fort Walton Beach this year, same place where the Jolly Green Giants, the helicopters and rescues, has their reunion. So we've had to back to back with them a couple of times, and it's great to get with the Air Force guys, but. Anybody who was involved in the operation is an automatic charter member. There's no dues, there's Navy guys, there's Air Force guys. There's no Army involved in the operation except for one guy. He was a Army interpreter that landed on one of the helicopters in the first wave. He refused to get off the helicopter and then went back to Thailand and was immediately discharged. That's the only Army involvement in the operation. Actually, had Coast Guard involvement and Merchant Marine, so we're pretty proud of the fact that it's basically all services that were part of the operation. But we got these reunions, and we with the website. Our website is Cotang.com, K-O-H-T-A-N-G.com, and the website's pretty strong. We've been building it, working it for several years. We got a hardcore group of 7-8 guys who are the mainstay. One's the treasurer, and one's the webmaster, and we have a new president every 2 years, et cetera, et cetera. But everybody's got their responsibilities, and everybody does what needs to be done, and we have a great time. One of the most rewarding things we did a couple of years ago was we had a reunion in D.C. We went to the walls together, and it was the first time for many of them going to the wall. And as most of you know, the wall was set up with the dates. 1959, I think it is, the first one. It's right in the center of the apex where the two angles meet. The first column to the right, it starts in 1959 and goes all the way in chronological order. It goes all the way to the other side and comes back. So 1975 is in the bottom right-hand corner of the left panel in the middle. And we've got a black vest we have with our patches and stuff on it, and many guys had hats on the different medals and decorations and stuff they have, Air Force, Navy, whatever. And we had this group, and we're working our way through the crowd, a lot of school kids. Ouch. And they just moved out of glory for us. And we all went to the middle. I get many guys for the first time, and a lot of guys crying and this and that. And we all stood there and looked at the names and said a little prayer and gave them a couple of souvenirs. But it's typical of the feeling you get when you're with your brothers. It's just amazing. And really looking forward to this reunion that we're getting ready to have here in May. And if anybody's interested, please go to the website, coateng.com. We've got all kind of information on there about what's going on and what to do. And there's all kind of other information as far as videos and books and past accomplishments and such that we have done for the group. In 2013, we had a mass internment of the remains of the guys that were shot down on 9/13. Long and complicated story, but they're all in one mass grave in Arlington with a huge headstone with all their names on it. Yeah. We were there with the families for that. That was a huge story, but that was something we accomplished as the Tank Mountain this Veterans Organization. A lot of good stuff when you get with your brothers.
Dan, you know, if you would ask me before I started reading about Koteng Island, and this is one of the points I want to end with, you know, hey Mac, do you know anything about Koteng Island? What I would have responded with, isn't that where they left the three Marines?
Yeah.
After you read about it, okay. Although that is part of the story, no doubt about it. Okay. That is not what is first and foremost in your mind. What is first and foremost in your mind was that this shit show should have been an unmitigated American military disaster. And it was extracted out of the jaws of defeat by courageous Marines, sailors, and airmen that day. There was no reason for it to succeed because they had shit intel, they had shit command and control, and until that OB-10 showed up, they have shit fire support, even though everybody's trying that's down there on the ground. They can't coordinate it. And the courage of Marines, the fighting spirit of Marines on the deck, of the sailors that supported them, whether it be from a gig or the Holt, and the Air Force pilots who had never flown this kind of support in their lives, the balls that they showed that day will blow you away. And so, Dan, when you talk to people, when people ask about what should I read, there's a whole bunch of source documents on their website. Did I go to the website and check out the source documents? In terms of books, Dan, do you recommend books about the fight?
There's two ones that I will strongly recommend. The first one was written by a Joe Gil Martin, who was an Air Force Jolly 53 pilot. He was not involved in the operation, but it was his outfit that was, and he was the maintenance officer that got all the helicopters ready to go. He was a history professor at USC. Joe Gil Martin is called A Very Short War. It's primarily from the Air Force perspective, and all these horrific and horrible situations and how heroic the pilots were. And like I say, there were three Air Force crosses issued that day and a whole lot of Silver Stars and other medals as well to the Air Force. The other book I recommend is A 14-Hour War, written by Scott Barron and James Wise. I know it's available on Amazon and such. It's from the Marine perspective, and the authors actually interviewed a lot of the veterans and have their written perspective as part of the book. I'm on like 20-some pages, basically what I've reiterated with you here today. But it's a very good book as well. There's a couple others out there that I wouldn't recommend, but those two especially.
Got it. All right. Dan, first of all, I don't know that I can adequately say thank you enough for giving up your time and walking us through the operation, through the post-combat related mental health, your struggle, and ultimately Your triumph, I don't know your triumph is, I don't know if that's the right word. It sounds kind of odd to me to say that, but you're coming out of it. You're helping others and being a spokesman and a success story. So first of all, thank you very much. Congratulations on all your hard work and what you do for other veterans. And thank you very much, for coming on All Marine Radio. And I hope this, that we can do it again. Whenever you guys have anything going on, please don't hesitate to let me know. Or if you just care to talk about a veterans issue, let me know. And the door is wide open anytime that you care to use it, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's, been an honor and a privilege to be with you. I'm sorry if I got, a little emotional there a couple times, but, understanding PTSD, you know how that is.
No, let me just tell you, this is our tribe. It's All Marine Radio, and trust me, you're not the first person that's gotten emotional, especially when we go down and tell the story, the kind of stories that we tell during battlefield studies. Those are intimate memories of fighting next to Marines that you love and care about, and that stuff never goes away. You know, one of the things about post-traumatic stress and fighting for your country is you're not getting over it. The best you can do is learn to peacefully coexist with it, and that's as good as it gets. And so you don't have to apologize for that. We know it's part of our tribes, along with traumatic brain injuries, amputations, Agent Orange, and all kinds of other maladies that is associated with our tribe. And we apologize for none of it, and we're goddamn proud to have it and be a member of our tribe. So you don't owe anybody an apology, and as I said, the door is wide open. Anytime you want to come on and talk about whatever you want to, we'd be more than delighted to have you.
Well, thank you very much. Semper Fi.
Semper Fidelis. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. How about that? You know, I'll just say probably somewhere around 500 Cambodian soldiers waiting for him. And they had fought too. And their positions were such that they knew the only place that, if Americans ever came, there's only a couple places where they could land, and they had prepared position on the island. Yeah, 15 to 50 dudes, man. Land your company, no problem. Yeah, the regimental COC up in the air in some kind of C-130 variant tells the USS Wilson to orbit at 10,000 feet and they'll figure it out. What? Yeah. And they fight through all that. No, I mean, nobody capable. You know, should we take OB-10s? No, we don't need it. Well, you could have taken it and sent it home if you didn't need it. And I'll tell you what, the when that OB-10, his name was Undorf, when that son of a bitch shows up, it all changes because it all gets kind of glued together. He's flying around and he's looking to see who's where, and he's communicating with them, and he's telling them, hey, these guys are here, right? I got them. I'll shoot a rocket. Smoke comes up. Okay. These guys are here. Bad guys are, you know, northern limit is here. Southern limit here. And now they start putting it together. And he starts rolling in A-7s. He starts rolling in. He starts controlling the AC-130. That piece of, you know, that godsend of a fire support device. And he spots for the USS Wilson. As it
as it pulls up 1,000 meters and starts ripping 5-inch rounds into the island. 176 of them. Yeah, think about that. And then, and this is what's awesome about it. I mean, the Wilson is monitoring the battle. Nobody's telling the Wilson where to go or what to do. That guy figures it out on his own. He's listening. He's a warfighter. Launches dinghy with a 50 cal. Let's do this shit, boys. That's awesome, man. Motivating. And then, you know, the exploits of all those Air Force pilots that day. They hadn't trained with Marines. They didn't, you know, what we would, you know, for instance, what we would take for granted in my career, you know, flying in 46s or 53s, a couple times in Hueys, flying Nap of the Earth, right, to an LZ, crew chief telling you to unbuckle, right? And then you feel that, you know, you feel the aircraft go nose up, flare, boom, and on the ground in seconds. And then you're piling out the door. If you're in a 53, don't turn right. Okay? Turn left. If you're in a 46, go whatever way you're supposed to, right? Normally the squad leader out first, telling guys which direction to go. And then, boom, you're on it. None of that. None of that training. And this first lieutenant, Air Force first lieutenant named Blau. Bob Blau. How about that shit? He lands it on the helipad of a destroyer. That thing's like a postage stamp. He's flying a 53. But he knows if he doesn't get these guys out and go back, that those guys have a chance to be overrun. So he lands a son of a bitch, right, not on it, so he's having to fly it because he's got to keep half power because he thinks he might go into the drink because the helipad's too small. So he's got to fly it on the ship. Never done it before. And the Marines are piling out the side hatch. Turns around and goes back. Some big ass balls, man. And so to me, I'll say it for probably the fifth time today, but when I didn't know a whole lot about this operation. I would have been one of the people, like a lot of Marines, say, oh yeah, that's where they left the three Marines. Well, that isn't the story. That's a sad part of the story. But the story is that these Marines are put in a situation where they should have been, as a unit, they should have been destroyed. Those helicopters should have never got near them, except for an OV-10 Bronco pilot, USS Wilson, and those helicopter pilots. And you know, again, the story is Harold, the USS Harold E. Holt. Those sailors, those airmen, and those Marines, they yanked that son of a bitch out of the jaws of defeat. Literally, they brutally ripped it out because the firepower on that island, the heavy weapons, and then testament to that is, you know, the number of 53s that couldn't get back in the air that day and limped back to a base and could be repaired to go back. So my thanks to Dan Hoffman for coming on. And again, if you go to the website, there's some pretty cool stuff on the website. Again, it's called Kotang.com. So if you go to the website and there's all kinds of, if you click on media, you'll see videos, books, you'll see all kinds of stuff in there. Okay. However, I would direct you to a couple of pretty interesting things. One, if you go to 1975, find Greg Wilson's account, okay? He is a Nail 6-9, so he's one of the OV-10 Bronco pilots. And let me tell you, those guys were incredible because the people that were supposed to be doing that didn't have a clue. So, anyway, again, my thanks to Dan Hoffman for coming on. My thanks to you for listening. If you're joining the program late or just joining us, just sit back, relax. You're going to hear a little news coverage to tease it. General Dunford, optimistic. And in the articles that have been written about it, he's quoted as saying, I'm trying to contain my optimism for what I've seen here in Afghanistan. Things, if we told, you know, if we told you, you know, just when I was there 7 years ago, you would say, no way. And that is Afghan Air Force, followed by Afghan helicopters, followed by Afghan Special Forces, followed by Afghan police units to destroy the enemy, come in behind it, create some kind of order out of it, and so it's sustainable. News headline this morning is that in the near future, Afghan pilots are going to be piloting Black Hawk helicopters. Yeah. That's a good thing. So pretty interesting stuff. Pretty interesting stuff. The So you'll hear that. And then a couple of footnotes. I had a couple of emails relative to the transgender policy. And so we'll kind of go through the footnotes of that. And again, it's about deployability. Nobody in the DOD gives a shit about what sex anybody is. Either you can do it or you can't. But the thing is, you got to be deployable. And whether you're heterosexual, whether you're homosexual, whether you're transgender, male, female, I think Secretary Mattis has made it pretty clear. If you're not deployable, unless you're combat wounded, combat amputee, maybe there's a special class of citizen in the DOD that can't deploy like that or has limitations to their abilities to deploy, and we'll accept that because they've earned the right. They've earned that right. Okay. For everybody else, you got to be able to go. So we'll go through those footnotes as well. So anyway, thanks for listening here on a Wednesday, Battlefield Study Day. Love that. Another edition coming up next week. So have a great one on Hump Day. We will, see you tomorrow. The Gunner comes back. He sent me a text this morning. Yeah. He sent me a text this morning like 06. Hey, if you ever text me in the middle of the night, I'll kill you. He's like, oh, Mr. Grumpy. I'm like, dude, what are you texting me at 6 in the morning for? It's 8 o'clock here. I'm like, all right, we're not going to play that stupid game. So, yeah, that genius will be back tomorrow. So, have a great day on a Wednesday on Marine Radio. Out.